Hi, and welcome to the first episode of 2024 of the Leadership Enigma, where we continue our journey of curiosity. And again, I'm always excited and I'm supercharged now for the new year. And I'm delighted to welcome my first guest of the year, who is Thomas Tamora Promusic. And he will introduce himself to you. And certainly he is the author of 10 books and over 150 scientific papers. So I think I've found someone who is indeed curious himself. And there are so many questions that we will talk about. I mean, why do so many incompetent men become leaders is one of the questions I need to ask Thomas. But certainly we're going to double down on the human AI age, because that is certainly something that is at the forefront of many leaders and many organizations' mind. But what's it all about? Perhaps let's pop a few myths and get a reality check as we start off 2024. Come back to me just after this break. Hi, I'm Adam Pacifico, and welcome to The Leadership Enigma, a world-ranked, award-winning podcast that's insatiably curious as regards what leaders do, how they do it, and importantly, why. We'll delve into the human doing, but even deeper into the human being and the power of human-centered leadership to drive sustainable change. So whether you're an entrepreneur, business owner, corporate executive, each week we speak to global experts, academics, rising stars, ambitious upstarts and disruptors, as together we will discover that success leaves clues. So it's a warm welcome to Thomas. Thank you so much for being the first guest of the year. Happy New Year to you. How are you, sir?
And to you, Adam, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be invited, and thank you for having me on your show.
It's a real pleasure. Just tell us, where in the world are you at the moment?
At the moment, I'm in Italy, where we have a place, so in lovely Rome, and it's not too cold. Usually, I'm based in between New York and London, so, you know, partly where you are as well. And, you know, like for most people, post-COVID now, my travel is back to what it was, I would say, 2019, so I spend a lot of time in between places.
Yeah, no, I'm finding that myself. It really does seem to have gone back to the kind of the old rate of travel. Now, you're a bit of a jet setter, because I think, are you living in Manhattan as well, or Brooklyn, aren't you? Brooklyn and London, splitting your time?
That's correct. Yes, exactly.
But born in Buenos Aires, I believe.
Yes, which is a little bit less jet-setty, I would say, but still a lovely place, especially to visit, not so much to live. We do specialize in leadership crisis. So I think, you know, my early interest in the subject of leadership was very personal. I was, in essence, trying to figure out how people who are so smart can make such poor decisions, electing corrupt and incompetent people to run their countries over and over again, resulting in what I think is the longest perpetual economic decline of any nation. For 120 years, we've been declining economically, which is no small feat. I mean, it's a major achievement if you think about it.
Wow. So that was the catalyst for you being curious in relation to leaders and leadership and why do we do certain things? That's fascinating. And at the moment, you're currently the Chief Innovation Officer at Manpower Group, I believe. Is that still correct?
That's correct, yes. So my team's task is mostly to work out how to utilize all of the data we have from our job seekers or candidates. We have about 55 million people touching our various ecosystems every year, and our many, many thousands of clients looking for talent. And in essence, we look at how predictable performance, assessments, analytics, and even AI can help us improve search and match capabilities, so that people find better jobs and our clients find better talent.
So let me ask you a question. How did you actually get into, because you're really specializing in the psychology of talent, leadership, innovation, and AI. How did that come about?
Yeah, the short answer, Adam, is that one thing led to the next, right?
As it does.
There was no strategy whatsoever. I actually started my career in philosophy and psychoanalysis. So even though it involves human behavior, it's a very, very different kind of lens to look at people, very abstract, very theoretical, almost metaphysical. And upon realizing that I would probably be highly unemployable, I decided to do something different. So I kind of basically pivoted into the world of statistics, analytics, and data. At a time when, you know, people analytics didn't exist at a function, there were large organizations probably using assessment, but it was still very obscure, even when I was finishing my PhD. But then I think I got lucky because even though I started as a full-time academic, I was in demand first as a consultant and then started businesses that in essence created data-driven tools that help organizations select employees, managers, and leaders. And I always try to kind of keep, you know, active both in the research side and in the practice side. And really, I think probably my niche is to try to reduce the gap between the two, between science and practice, which is what I enjoy doing the most.
Now, I know, and I mentioned at the start that you are a prolific writer and researcher as well. I think 10 books and 150 scientific papers so far. Those figures may well be out of date now. So where's that coming from as well, this kind of abundance of writing?
I think writing for me is very cathartical. You know, this is mostly the first thing I do as soon as I wake up. I think I wake up with thoughts and, you know, it's a way to organize my thinking. It also, you know, fits a purpose. If it's academic writing, it's important because then if you are a practitioner that wants to go directly to the sources and understand what the research says, whether it's a complex academic paper or something that is more of a kind of a broader audience communication, you can understand what the findings are and apply it if helpful. And if it's more of a kind of business audience or popular writing, I think it's important to evangelize because there's a lot of noise in this area. So if you don't, you know, tell what you see in an area and if you don't communicate the facts as you see them and the findings that you have, you know, it's more likely that people are distorted by maybe, you know, more populist than kind of enjoyable or personally rewarding findings that are very far away from the facts. So I think, you know, debunking myths and trying to kind of present a data-driven or fact-based, evidence-based perspective on things is something I enjoy doing. And you can only do it by speaking and writing. Writing usually reaches a wider audience. Although, of course, you know, podcasts like you reach a lot of people, and people are also a little bit too attention deprived to read these days. So I think videos and audio podcasts are a very good alternative as well.
Well, I'm hoping that there are people are going to be watching this and also listening to us, maybe as they're jogging, they're cooking, who knows what they're doing. So let me ask you, when was the first time that you started to bring the psychology and the people and the analytical pieces together and realize that actually you could shed light or create insight when perhaps it was a little bit foggy for people?
Yeah, so, you know, so academically, it was when I started my PhD. At the time, you know, I was really, really, so I had just moved from Argentina to the UK. I was very interested in this concept of social intelligence, even political intelligence, what it is that makes people effective in organizations beyond things like their IQ, their academic qualifications, etc. And EQ was really taking off in from a research standpoint. Right. But it was still somewhat obscure. So what I decided to do instead is to look at whether there are certain competencies that we know from the personality realm, including curiosity, which I know you're a big fan of, and things like empathy, drive, motivation, conscientiousness, that if you combine them and you kind of make a little blend or mix with them, can add or have incremental power predicting success over and above things like learning ability or IQ. That was the academic thesis, which probably three people, one of them was my mom, read. I mean, maybe my mom didn't finish it, but, you know, as academic thesis go,
thank heaven for our moms.
Somewhere, yeah, exactly. Gathering dust in the library, I would say. But then I did the first book on that, which was a little bit kind of broader. And then I started to kind of try to reach more of a trade or broad audience, really trying to shed light on some of the misconceptions that often, you know, I would say distort our ability to see potential in the workplace. So one of them was probably the first that really became a bit of a hit was this tendency to focus too much on confidence and too little on competence.
Right.
The story is very simple that, you know, most selection and assessment methods and most short-term interactions between humans over-index how good people think they are as opposed to how good they actually are. And there's actually a really interesting evolutionary explanation for the pervasive nature of this optimism bias, this stealth kind of deception or delusion. You know, we all tend to think that we're better than we actually are. We all tend to think that we're going to live longer, that we're healthier, that we're happier, that we're funnier, that we're more creative, that we're better lovers than we actually are, and that other people think we are. But there's an evolutionary reason for this, which is that if you bullshit yourself first, it's a lot easier for you to bullshit others without even having to lie. So just like the best salespeople don't lie because they truly believe that they have a killer product, right? Self-deception is the most powerful way to basically be effective at deceiving others. But of course, this can work at the individual level. But if you have a system, an organization in which only people who are really good at bullshitting themselves succeed, you have a parasitic system, you have a corrupt organization, you have an inept organization that is very far removed from a talent-centered or merit-based organization. So that, I think, was the beginning.
I see, I love that. And so that's fascinating, and that's piqued my curiosity already, as you can imagine, Thomas, because there's an element, isn't there, of self-confidence in believing in yourself in order to perform or in order to achieve. But what's the mitigation strategy then to allow people to be self-confident, but as you say, to also allow people to understand that the BS isn't something that they should be passing on to others? What's the mechanism there to find that balance between the two?
Yeah, so I think it starts with understanding a fundamental rule in human affairs, especially in psychological traits, which is that, as even Aristotle noted many, many centuries ago, millennia ago, all things are best in moderation. So confidence, like drive, like even people skills, like self-control, like extroversion, like attention to detail, are better in moderation than in extremis.
Right.
And, you know, the right level of confidence is not one that is so high that it starts to be decoupled or detached with your actual competence. It's one that actually is aligned with your skills. If you're trying to learn a new language, or you're trying to learn how to play the piano, or you're trying to learn, I don't know, how to ski or how to, you know, be a good manager, the right level of confidence is one that actually indicates to you how you're doing. It helps you monitor progress. If it starts to be too inflated, you might think that you're fluent in Japanese, or that you are Mozart or Chopin, or that you are, you know, Satya Nadella as a manager or leader. And when people look at you, they're like, oh my God, it looks more like Ricky Gervais in The Office, right? David Brent or Steve Carell, if you want the American version. So at the same time, of course, nobody likes the idea of being pathologically insecure. I'm not predicating or preaching that we should be riddled by doubt and inhibited by our anxieties because we think, you know, we have severe imposter syndrome. But actually, if you look at the data, there's far fewer people with imposter syndrome than actual imposters in charge in very high senior positions in organizations. So, you know, the self-help movement has popularized this notion that people need to think more highly of themselves.
Yes.
And it's worshiping self-belief at the expense of self-awareness. What's important is that we improve self-knowledge. Every good coach, I know you work a lot with coaches, will tell you, what I try to help my clients do is to know themselves better, especially how they're seen by others. Not to think that they're the best person in the world. Probably they already have quite a high opinion of themselves if they are in these positions of power.
So what I'm hearing is that it's almost like a scale. You've got to try and make sure that you're at the right point of the scale, not too much of one, not too much of the other, but you're always trying to find the balance. And I'm assuming that balance shifts as we grow older and wiser and more experiences. Would that also be fair?
This is a good question, right? Because in general, from the evolutional pattern of or developmental pattern of personality through the lifespan, actually does see the majority of people maturing or, you know, gravitating towards emotional maturity, which unfortunately is also a euphemism for being boring. Mm. As we grow older, you know, we become
there's no hope
more
for
pleasant.
Me.
Yeah, we become, for me either, you know, I'm in that same boat. We become more boring, more pleasant, more polite, more cautious, more conservative, right? Even if you look at political orientation, there's a reason why people are more likely to be conservative when they're old, because our brains start to slow down and we're more interested in preserving the ideas than disrupting them and changing. So actually, if you look at curiosity, it starts to decline after the age of 20, 30 for most people. There are exceptions, of course, but for most people. So basically, the majority of people have a natural tendency to actually become a little bit wiser, if you like, because that means that hubris is less of the norm. Right. And, you know, we become a little bit, ideally, you also know yourself more, you can predict your behavior better. But there's another counter effect to that, which is that as you grow older, as people grow older, they also become more successful. There's still a massive ageism bias that actually, you know, most jobs, most positions of powers, you work a lot with leaders, you cannot aspire to if you don't have gray hair, if you don't look old, and if you're not old. So actually, power can, in a very kind of morbid way, can reinforce the inner narcissism that you have, right? The old line that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely is true, because if you are powerful and you're senior, people will have a tendency to suck up to you. That's why psychological safety is such an important counter argument, because even if you tell people, guys, I tell my team, please criticize me, tell me what I'm doing wrong. They know you're your boss, that you're their boss. So they have a tendency to say, oh, Adam, you've been fantastic. I love your work, whatever. And then if you listen to them, you think, okay, I must be great. And then the narcissism inflates your self-concept and your self-confidence as you grow older as well.
So what would be your single biggest insight to offer leaders in relation to this aspect? So anyone who's leading right now, what would be your biggest piece of advice for people?
Oh, I think first, two things. First, take inspiration from the great leaders. The most effective leaders in any field actually are their worst critics. They actually suffer from a very adaptive and positive version of imposter syndrome, that even when others are thinking like, wow, you're amazing, they're like, this wasn't good enough, I have to work harder. So it's almost like they have this inherent ambition that is an inability to be satisfied with their achievements. Even when they accomplish something, they want more and more and more. Of course, that can end up being pathological if then they want to take over the world or even Mars, right? No examples needed. But at the same time, you know, when it's not that extreme or even at extreme levels, it accounts for a lot of progress in society. The second is that from a practical standpoint, they can surround themselves with people who aren't yes-man people, who aren't, you know, stuck-ups, who aren't just there to engage in basically compliments and fake positive feedbacks. We all have people, even if they work with us and for us, who are our junior kind of colleagues, who, if we request it, are capable of providing us with that reality check that actually keeps our egos in check. And, you know, there are very simple hacks for doing that. When you do something, if you want feedback, don't ask people, wasn't I great? But tell them, what would you have done differently? What could I have done better? So I think getting into the habit of ingesting or crowdsourcing negative feedback from others requires courage, but it's a really good way to keep your egos in check. And then, of course, work with a good coach. Sometimes coaches are upset when I say that the aim of coaching is to actually lower leaders' confidence, not to elevate it. But to some degree, it is, because most leaders already think too highly of themselves. That was the subject of why so many competent leaders, men become leaders and how to fix it. So actually helping them understand that they have flaws, gaps, and weaknesses, or opportunities, as they're called in HR, is the number one kind of starting point to improve and get better.
So it's interesting, the more senior and perhaps the more powerful, if that's the right word, that any leader becomes, actually the more a leader can insulate themselves from any kind of adverse feedback and in some ways just feed whatever delusion may be going on. So that's interesting from that aspect. And you just talked about, I think, one of the many TED Talks that you've done, why do so many incompetent men become leaders, is something... it's on your website. I'll get you to give the address at the end of this episode so people can see that for themselves. But I'm also going to ask, there was a lovely video on there, and I'll ask you just to comment on this, why we should be more sexist, because I wonder whether we're also talking about the role of men as leaders, the role of women as leaders. What was your finding or your insight in relation to that particular TED Talk, why we should be more sexist?
Yeah, and so that... Both talks are based on this book, which is not the last one, but the previous one. Yep. So your viewers can see it here. Why do so many incompetent men become leaders, and how to? There's a little part on how to fix it, right? Mostly is the why, but then if you get to the end, you can see the how to fix it part. And actually, although why we should be more sexist is a clickbaity and provocative title, the idea is that actually sexism in particular, feminism is a data-driven bias when it comes to leadership, because we have all these data for at least 4 or 5 decades showing that, first, when you look at the hard skills that make leaders more effective, things like academic qualifications or educational credentials, including, by the way, how many people, men or women, finish MBAs and do well at MBAs. And I'm not saying that you need an MBA to be a leader, but it still is one of the main educational kind of criteria to select people into leadership roles.
Right.
So hard skills, right? Qualifications. Today, women outnumber and outperform men at university and the vast majority of countries, including, by the way, very sexist countries. So hard skills and academic credentials, women are better than men. Soft skills that make leaders more effective. Things like empathy, emotional intelligence, self-control, self-awareness, humility, integrity, EQ, all of these skills, which actually have become even more important in leaders in the AI age, on average, women outperform men. And finally, if you look at the dark side personality traits that make leaders ineffective, even if they advance their career, but when they turn them into kind of organizational parasite and toxic, destructive leaders,
yeah,
things like narcissism, psychopathy, Machiavellianism, antisocial trait, men score much higher, significantly higher on these traits on average than women. So the point is simple that, of course, you know, in an ideal world, leader selection would be gender blind. It would be like a wine tasting. You don't look at the label, you just taste it and you just look at potential, and actually any data-driven intervention can help you do that. If we selected leaders on their potential and leader selection was gender blind, we would not just end up with more women in leadership roles. We would end up with more women than men in leadership roles. So when I say we should be more sexist, what I mean is there's a data-driven way to be more sexist and favor women, which, by the way, is the complete opposite of putting in place, you know, positive discrimination, quotas, affirmative actions, which I understand are well-intended and often can create bigger change faster than the utopian method that I am kind of advocating for.
Right.
But at the same time, we know that all of that backfires because it reinforces the prejudice and the stereotype that people have, incorrect and inaccurate stereotype, that, oh, women need help, you know, extraneous forces or measures to help them get to leadership roles because they don't have what it takes to be leaders, which reinforces the misconception that leadership today is a meritocratic contest, that the people who are at the top are the best ones. If that were the case, then we wouldn't have such high failure rates for leadership or management positions everywhere you look at in organizations and nations. So what I'm saying is that, you know, I call myself a sexist because I am a feminist, but a data-driven feminist, and sexism is the belief that one gender is better than another. When it comes to leadership, the data are very clear. My belief is based on this data, that women, on average, are better leaders than men.
I've never heard the phrase data-driven feminist before, so that's a new one for 2024 as we go. And why we should be more sexist is also a video that I know is on your site, and again, I'll help refer people to that. There's another topic that I want to talk about, and I love the fact that we're covering a series of topics here as we catapult into the new year for all those topics that I think are relevant to leaders. And I've got to talk to you about the work that you're doing within the human AI age. And I know sequentially you've been writing books which have perhaps inevitably led to where we are right now. So tell us a little bit about how you've now started to focus on the AI age and the human element and the patterns and the urgency. Just kind of give that a little bit of an update for us.
Yeah, sure. And so that's based on this latest book, which is called I, Human, AI, Automation, and the Quest to Reclaim What Makes Us Unique.
Yes.
And in a way, it is somewhat of an unlikely sequence to the book on incompetent men becoming leaders, because the how to fix it part basically says, how do we stop or reduce the number of incompetent men that become leaders, is we become more data-driven, which incidentally would also allow more competent men to reach leadership positions. I'm not, you know, arguing that only women should be, I'm arguing that people with competence should get there. So that actually would involve pretty radical change, because we would have to de-emphasize things like face-to-face interview or the selection interview, we would have to de-emphasize things like performance appraisals or reviews, which are a little bit of a popularity contest. And, you know, although AI gets a lot of criticism and stick for potentially introducing or augmenting biases in systems, actually, AI has the ability to unlearn things, whereas humans find it very, very hard to do. And so, you know, when I finished that book, I said, okay, you know, AI clearly has the potential to make organizations more data-driven. Let's look at it first in the context of leader selection. And as I was writing that book in the middle of the COVID pandemic, and like everybody else, I was detached from interpersonal contact and under the heavy influence of all these algorithms, I noticed that actually the topic of AI was going to become much, much, much bigger. So it ended up being a book about what it means to be human, including what it means to be a leader in an age in which so much of our thinking and our creativity could potentially be outsourced to machines. There was a bit of luck with the timing because the book came out on the same day that OpenAI launched ChatGPT. So it's getting a lot of traction because of that. But I think it's the fundamental leadership challenge of today. So, of course, we need to ensure that the people that get to leadership positions are competent and that they become better and that can develop. But I think the number one task for them is to work out, you know, how to humanize their organizations, how to move beyond thinking that AI will make people more productive, which is almost like going back 100 years to assembly lines and Friedrich Taylor's view of, you know, people being just another tool in the ginormous cockpit of this industrial assembly line, and really humanize work, and how to kind of ensure that people want to save some time outsourcing boring tasks to machines, to AIs, but then motivate them so that they reinvest their time they save on reskilling and upskilling themselves, on actually cultivating their curiosity and upgrading, you know, their own humanity, because AI will continue to upgrade themselves. But the question that I ask is, how can we as humans ensure that we don't downgrade ourselves or we don't become diluted as a species because, you know, AI can do everything that we were once doing. And then, you know, this, we almost automate ourselves.
So let me ask you some basic questions. And then hopefully, again, I can refer people. You talked about that AI is actually potentially worsening some of the bad tendencies, which we've spoken about. So making us more distracted, selfish, biased, narcissistic, entitled, predictable, and impatient. Help me understand, what is AI doing to sometimes dial that up for people?
Yeah, so maybe we'll pick two or three so I can flesh them out a little bit. But, you know, if we start with bias, which is an interesting one. First, you know, because we're very quick to blame AI for being biased, when in fact, more often than not, it's either exposing a bias that exists in the system or exacerbating just because it can optimize for, you know, speed and efficiency. But for instance, I'm sure you're familiar with, you know, the cases where organizations try to train chatbots, so an early version of to the LLMs, to predict who should get promoted in an organization. And when we train that AI with past historical data, you know, then that AI recommends a surplus of middle-aged white male engineers, to which we say, oh my God, AI is sexist or biased, we should stop it. No, AI is exposing what happens there. If we don't use AI, that's still happening because that's what's rewarded in the organization. Outside work, most of us live or inhabit filter bubbles, you know, digital cocoons and echo chambers where algorithms optimize the content curation for what we want to see, right? This could very, very easily change. Like, you could retweak or retool the algorithms of Netflix, Spotify, Amazon, LinkedIn, Twitter, even Tinder or dating kind of matching sites to recommend you stuff that you don't like, but that you should consider to become a more open-minded version of yourself. If you did that, everybody would defect to another platform because, you know, we love our biases and AI has done a wonderful job co-opting them and creating a version of reality that makes our biases a version of reality to the point that we are totally unaware that there is something else, which is why the world is becoming more tribalized, more polarized, and why it's harder for us to even talk to people who think differently. There's a very interesting statistic that I mentioned in the book. 85% of people describe themselves as open-minded. 15% of people were deemed persuadable by Cambridge Analytica and all these other algorithms that were looking at, you know, who is it worth targeting with fake or real news? So that's the bias one. Narcissism is similar and very easy to understand. You know, most of us interact with AI through social media platforms. Those social media platforms, of course, mine and monetize our data, and they get more value out of the data, and they become more valuable as companies if they create sticky content. What they mostly reward is self-promotional activities. Social media, through the AI that fuels it, has normalized digital narcissism. In the real world, in the 3D world, if you walk around an office telling everybody how amazing you are, what you did over the weekend, that you got upgraded to first class, and of course sharing with everybody what your cat had for breakfast, you'll be deemed pretty obnoxious and pretty, you know, annoying. But in social media, this will make you an influencer. And that's all due to AI kind of harnessing our inner narcissism. So if left unchecked, you know, AI has this tendency to augment our undesirable features. Same, of course, for impulsivity and impatience. You know, in the early days, you and I are probably old enough to remember that in the early days of the internet, it was exciting to listen to those 30 seconds of dial-up connection, you know, when you were getting online.
Well.
Now, if your Netflix or, you know, browser freezes for 2 seconds, you are close to taking the TV or the computer and smashing it or throwing it through the window, right? So we're becoming so impatient, and that's the consequence of optimizing for speed, for efficiency. And one of the problematic side effects of that is that we're thinking less, you know? We're optimizing everything. We're outsourcing our thinking to machines. And ironically, the time we save is spent trying to, you know, create new logins, fight new technological inefficiencies, or battle through, you know, all these oversensory overload that we're bombarded with.
So am I right in thinking, actually, because I have two teenagers, that the younger generation have known nothing else. So they have been born and bred into an era of immediate information. And, you know, if they want something, you order it and Amazon delivers it almost the next day. If you want data or information, bang. They've known nothing else, Thomas. Nothing.
They haven't. And, you know, it's too soon to look at, you know, changes, structural changes in the brain. I mean, those studies will come later. Wow. There's some neuroscientists are saying, look, it took us a long time to understand what decades of chain smoking or compulsive smoking did to our bodies. We might have the attentional equivalent to our brains, but, you know, it's too soon to see. So therefore, we should be cautious. But yeah, I have smaller children. My six-year-old, when for the first time she was, you know, she encountered this old school phenomenon called, you know, normal television, because we were traveling.
Right.
And she wanted to change the content. And I said, no, this is the channel. You can't change it. And she'll just fast forward when an ad came. It's like... She couldn't believe it, right? It's like, how is it possible that I'm not in control and that instant gratification cannot come soon enough?
That's the problem, isn't it? The instant gratification piece. But then you also talk about the fact that we've got to double down on curiosity, adaptability, EI, which we've spoken about, and really also dial into things such as empathy, humility, and self-control. Now, I'm extremely interested in this because a lot of my work is in relation to the power of human-centered leadership. So empathy, humility, vigilance, curiosity, inclusivity, personal purpose. Just from the work that I've done, which is nowhere as robust as the work that you have done, these for me are standing out as what I've described as leadership superpowers. Sometimes described as soft skills, I think they are some of the hardest skills for a leader to dial up. And so tell us a little bit about why those are so important, why those are perhaps so unique to the human in an AI age.
Yeah. So you're definitely onto something here. And I think, you know, the reason why you probably got interested in those, we can call them soft skills, although you're absolutely right. You know, I mean, some people call them now power skills in academic contexts that were more transferable or generic or foundational skills. You can also call them competence or personality. But I think the reason why a lot of people were already paying attention to those skills before the rise of AI was that, you know, historically for decades, we had put people into leadership roles based on their expertise, based on their hard skills based on their knowledge. And as those things become less relevant and now completely disrupted by AI, because even the wise, you know, I think you have to go back to the 18th century and found encyclopedias like Voltaire and Diderot and maybe Descartes before that were true polymath or Leonardo, right? They knew everything and they could answer a question. Now that's a machine and everybody has access to it. So if the knowledge and content part of leadership, including things like setting strategy, can be done by AI and machines, what's a leader there for? And a leader is there for inspiring, motivating, creating the right culture and climate, creating safety, making others better, and fundamentally catering to the need that people have for human affection and human validation. AI won't do that, right? I mean, we've seen examples of AI already copying and emulating things like empathy. So hospitals in the US outsource patient communication to ChatGPT, and patients actually experience more empathy from AI than their doctors. Wow. But that's not because the doctors can't do it. They're just too busy doing something else, right? And I think a similar thing will apply to corporate leaders. So that's for, you know, empathy, people skills, EQ. So they will be the definitive and the differentiating leadership skills of the future. And they already are today, I think. Then there's curiosity. Because even though AI has now commoditized and crowdsourced and synthesized access to information, I think it's a little bit, things like ChatGPT are a little bit like a microwave for ideas, right? It's not going to be that nutritional. It's not going to be that nourishing. It's not going to be that healthy, but it will give you that quick fix. It's going to be, you know, the fast and furious, lazy, cheap, maybe free option when you need to know something. Nobody's going to waste time on conversations. We were already not doing it since Google came around about who was president in this year or who won the Premier League in that year, because you can access that information. Having said that, just like the rise of fast food created the slow food movement and the farm to table movement and a healthier need or a need for kind of more healthy and nourishing or nutritional options, I think if generative AI is the fast food of ideas, we need to work on creating the slow food version of ideas. And that's why even if you look at the role of human expertise, they won't disappear. You're just going to have to work harder to showcase that what you know adds value over what people can crowdsource for free theirs, right? So social proof is very important for people who have a reputation and a track record and are our age. Probably we're going to be fine. But for somebody starting now, for your kids and my kids, they have to really, really dig deep into an area and unleash their curiosity so that I think there's a very simple test to know whether you know something. How quickly can you spot mistakes in ChatGPT or in Wikipedia on any topic?
Right.
If you look at something and after 5 seconds, you think, wow, now I know a lot about the medieval times or, you know, French wine or, you know, whatever, sports cars or American history. That's because you knew nothing and you believe the superficial microwave version of what you're crowdsourcing. If you are an expert, you will see within seconds what's wrong. And I think, you know, in a way now, AI is pushing humans to develop deep expertise. And that only comes if we unlock our deep curiosity.
Wow. So I love that reference to AI actually being the microwave meal. That's something that's going to stand out for me. And again, I'm delighted as well that it highlights the importance of human-centered leadership, because this is something that has come from my research. And in many ways, it's anecdotal. And I've put some labels to it. But again, I'm hearing more and more from guests in different fields just how important this is. Thomas, how can people get in touch with you and access some of the videos that we've spoken about so they can delve a little deeper? What's the best way?
Yeah, so the best way is they can go to my website, which is drthomas.com, and that's Thomas with no H, so drthomas.com.
Okay.
And there's a link there where they can email me as well. My fax machine hasn't been working for a while, so I won't give that number.
But we're old enough to remember.
Exactly. Yeah. That was another nice noise, right? The fax coming in.
Do you remember? Exciting. We used to get excited. Yeah. Where you hear the the tone in the background, and then you'd rush over to it, and then it would eventually come through. That's yeah, it might come
back. You know, it might be like vinyl. Maybe it's coming back. We'll all have fax machines and the dial-up connection while we spend time in analog means with open-minded people far away from AI surveillance. It might be the future, you know, who knows?
Well, maybe that's why people are finding it important to detox now and get away from everything so we can enjoy and embrace the analog world. Let me ask you an unfair question, Thomas. With all of the work that you've written, all of the research you've carried out, is there a piece of leadership advice that stands out for you that you've given or received over the years? Is there something that's a real standout guiding light for you?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, the one I love, and I think it came as a combination of things that, you know, I experienced myself, I read, etc. But I think, you know, one that I really, really like is try not to become an exaggerated version of yourself. So in a way, you know, it's sort of like the antidote to strengths movement and like, you know, be more of what you're good at already or develop the skills, you know, actually, you know, go against your nature. If you learn to go against your nature and you try not to become an exaggerated version of yourself, you're probably going to improve. It's almost like becoming more diverse internally as a person and becoming a more complete human being. So that's the one I love.
Well, and that is the one that we're going to end on. So, Thomas, thank you so much from Italy joining us for the first episode of the new year for the Leadership Enigma. It's been absolutely great. Thank you so much. I'm going to check out some of the resources on your website. I'll also put the reference to that website onto the show notes as well so that people can just click on that and go straight through. But you've been an absolute superstar. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for having me.
Take care now. Join us again next week for more curiosity and insight with the Leadership Enigma. We'd love to hear your comments on today's show as well as suggestions for future topics and guests. Get in touch with me on LinkedIn or visit us at www.leadersenigma.com. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe on all your major podcast platforms and on our dedicated YouTube channel. Thanks again for joining the community.